All rise. Oye, oye, oye. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, draw nigh and give your attention, for this Honorable Court is now in session. Be seated.
Good afternoon. I'm Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Hagel. To my left is Judge Davis. We're here today in the matter of Jones versus Shinseki, docket number 062036. Will counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record? Welcome. Thank you.
Looking at your on behalf of the Secretary of Veterans Affairs.
And who is with you?
With me as co-counsel is David Quinn.
Thank you. Welcome. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Each party will have 30 minutes to present their respective arguments. Mr. Carpenter, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
I would, Your Honor, if I could please reserve 10 minutes.
You have it. Please proceed.
May it please the Court. Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. Claybon Jones. This case turns on two central questions. The first question is the difference between a pending appeal, which is what exists in this case, is different from a pending claim. And if so, whether the pending appeal can be cured by a subsequent or later adjudication of the same issues which were the subject matter of the appeal that was pending.
Mr. Carpenter, I think we got that in your brief. So my question to you is, your client was awarded benefits in 95, the 95 board decision.
Actually, he was 98.
98 board decision. And it's your view that the 73 claim remained open until then?
That's correct, yes. Well, actually, not the 73 claim per se, but the 73 appeal.
73
appeal.
The claim
necessarily remains open. But
so it remained open until then?
That's correct.
Would you say that that decision subsumed the 73 claim?
No, I do not believe that the subsuming doctrine, which is a function of the a VA regulation,
right,
applies in this context.
Right. So what did it do to the 73 claim? Just close the claim that it the appeal that had remained open?
Well, under this court's decision in Myers, what it does is it recognizes that there was an interrupted claim stream, and once there is a resolution to that which was pending, the Myers case calls for the matter to be returned to the agency to determine under Fenderson the appropriate rating to be assigned and the appropriate effective date.
Okay, I understood that. What I didn't understand is why the same effect didn't occur in the 86 board decision that denied the benefits. In other words, if the 95 or 98, whatever year we're talking about, can somehow close the opening of the appeal, why didn't the 86 board decision close that open appeal?
Well, I number one, there isn't any case law that gives us any guidance in that regard, because it has never arisen, at least that I'm aware of or that I can find, in which this court has been required to address that circumstance. However,
I think what Judge Castle's asking, and I don't presume to know what he's asking, but what pops up in my mind is if the logic that you present, that the claim remains open and is closed by the 95 decision, why doesn't that same logic apply to the intervening 86 and I think 88 board decisions?
Well,
it's the same logic, isn't it?
Well, it's the same logic with one exception, Your Honor. The exception is that in Myers, the presumption is that there is a successful disposition. And that's what I was attempting to suggest, is that we have not been confronted with the circumstance that this case presents is when there's an intervening unsuccessful disposition. And then the question does become whether the logic applies to both circumstances. And I think that's where we have to focus in on whether or not there is an ability.
Okay, why wouldn't it?
Why wouldn't it?
Why wouldn't the same logic apply
to the intervening decision?
Right.
Intervening board decision.
Right.
Accepting your argument that an RO decision can't do anything with a prior decision that's already on appeal.
Because the intervening board decision, in this case the 1986 decision, did not cure the defect. It is Mr. Jones's position that there is one way and only one way in which that defect can be cured.
Is the defect you're referring to the failure to issue an SOC?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that is the procedural defect that is recognized in a series of cases from this court going back to Cow, Tablazon, and Myers. And they all focus on the fact that you can't, that 7105 is mandatory. When there is a notice of disagreement filed, there must be a statement of case issued. The question then becomes, can an intervening board decision, which does not acknowledge that there is an outstanding statement of the case, be considered to have cured somehow inferentially that defect?
Well, you're talking about a technical defect, okay? In the 86 board decision, was there not a notice of disagreement filed, and was there not an SOC issued?
There was, Your Honor. But they
Didn't the board decide the same issues that were in the didn't the, both the RO and the board in 86 decide the same issues that were presented in 74?
No, they did not.
What
in
issue didn't they decide?
In 1986, what was decided was the question of reopening. And that is not an issue that is capable of being subsumed under the subsumption notion. And
that's true with 88. Let me double check and see. I didn't think that was true with 86.
I believe that it's true with 86, Your Honor, although the reason that there is some confusion is that the board sort of takes it both ways, because when he filed his claim in 1983, Mr. Jones sought to include consideration of post-traumatic stress disorder.
But assuming it did apply. Assuming it was, while he's looking that up, assuming it was a denial of reopening at the board level, haven't we already held that at the RO level, a denial of reopening is sufficient notification to the veteran that his claim stream, had been denied? And why wouldn't that same theory apply, that when you get a denied reopening, the fact of the matter is the benefit you're seeking has been denied and you may appeal that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, that's directly contradictory to the holding in Tablazon, and that was the precise issue that was in Tablazon.
No, you misunderstood me.
I'm sorry.
RO decision remained open, no question.
Correct.
Subsequent RO decision 10 years later reviewed it on an issue of reopening it and denied that there was new material to reopen it. We've held that now closes the claim stream. That has been held on the top of my fingertips, have the case, but...
Ingram and Juarez.
Thank you.
Well, but with respect, Your Honor, I'd like to try to get this clarified because it's very important in this case. That is not the holding in either Ingram or Juarez. Neither case dealt with reopening. Both of those cases, the Ingram case dealt with a pension claim that was raised by the evidence. The Juarez case was in a subsequent case in which they requested reopening, and that request for reopening was denied. What was held in Juarez was, and was adopted in the by the Federal Circuit in Williams in adopting this court's decision in Ingram, was the notion that when the same issue is presented, but it is not the same issue, because the issue in this case is Mr. Jones's right to a statement of case in response to his notice of disagreement. Had the board acknowledged in 1986 that there was a prior procedural error, I believe they could have remedied that. But they did not do that. They simply proceeded on as though this were part of a continuing claim stream in an attempt to reopen. If the court...
Well, counsel, the 86 board decision actually does not deal with the reopening issue. It's an entitlement question, and I think Judge Hagel raised that point. The 88 decision deals with the reopening issue, but not the 86 decision. And in particular, the 86 decision deals with the nervous condition, entitlement to service connection for residuals of exposure to Agent Orange, and for a nervous condition, as well as entitlement to permanent and total disability rating for pension purposes. Record on appeal at 302 and forward.
But in the findings of fact at 311, they deal with this as a reopened claim, recognizing the originating agency decision in 1977, which denied the condition. And that actually was not the first decision. The first decision was in 1974. The first, may have been in 1973, but the notice of disagreement was filed in 1974 and made findings about the evidence that was added to the record. And that's why I suggest that they really sort of treated this both ways. They treated this both as a reopening and consideration of new and material evidence and considering PTSD for the first time in this particular board decision. But the legal question here, Your Honor, is whether or not what happened in this 1986 decision can be held as a matter of law to have either addressed or cured the procedural defect. And the procedural defect here is the lack of receipt of a statement of the case.
Well, let's assume that we agree with you that this was a reopening, okay? But that that the regional office, in the course of issuing their decision, denied or addressed the issue of the nervous condition and PTSD, which I think they did.
Yes, they did.
Okay. So the RO addressed it. He filed a notice of disagreement, and he got a statement of the case.
In the underlying decision that led up to the 86
correct.
Board?
Correct, not the 74
yes.
decision.
That's correct. Castle,
there's no question that remained open at that point in time. So he got his statement of the case with regard to nervous condition and PTSD. Denied. He exercises appellate rights and he goes to the board. Now, even assuming that you say that we would agree with you that they decided it solely on the basis of a reopening, how is it that this is error, other than the technical aspect of the fact that they didn't issue a statement of the case in 74? He's got a notice. He's got notice of that his claim has been denied. He's got a statement of the case, and he's been able to exercise his appellate rights as they were available at that time. Isn't that all that he's entitled to? Why has he been otherwise prejudiced?
Because I think he was entitled to, what he's entitled to at this point is the benefit under Myers. And the benefit under Myers says is when you have this circumstance, then you get to go back to that original claim.
Of course, now we have Ingram and Williams to deal with.
Well, that's correct.
That's why we're here.
But that's right. And Ingram and Williams and Juarez all dealt with pending claims. None of the decisions of this court have yet to deal.
Why does it make a difference?
Because the requirement to adjudicate, or excuse me, the requirement to issue a statement of the case is statutory. And it is part of
sure.
the appellate process that was initiated.
Why? What is the purpose of a statement of the case?
To inform the veteran of the relevant provisions of law and the reasons, to explain the reasons for the veteran for the VA's initial decision.
Correct.
And
so they can formulate the basis of an appeal to the board.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, didn't he get that in his way up to the 86?
I don't believe he did, Your Honor, and I think that's what's critical here is that what he
what
got
what piece of
was,
evidence didn't what piece what was he not advised of in the on the way, I don't remember what the date of the RO decision was, but in the statement of the case that was issued in the RO decision, what notice did he not get that he would have been entitled to in 74?
I don't think this is a question of notice, Your Honor. If it was a question of notice, then this case would be controlled by Ingram and Williams. This is a case of a procedural defect in a statutory obligation to provide a statement of the case.
Well, we just heard from the Supreme Court in Sanders that we're not supposed to, we're supposed to look at the prejudicial error of any possible technical error that exists. And so this is pretty important,
most certainly is.
So how was the individual prejudiced by this failure to, which we all acknowledge existed, a failure to issue the statement of the case when one was subsequently issued on the same issues, which provided notice that his claim in 74 was denied and gave him the basis for the RO's decision so that he could appeal to the board.
Well, Your Honor, I think it depends on whether or not this was an error in the first instance or this is an error that is discovered, as in this case, after the fact. In other words, what arose in Myers was you were confronted with a situation in which the record disclosed a pending appeal, as opposed to being part of the appellate process and realizing that there was something missing. That's not what happened in the facts of this case, and that's not what happened in Myers. And the prejudice to Mr. Jones is to now be deprived of the benefit that he would have otherwise been entitled to under Myers, to have the effective date considered all the way back to 1973. And that's where the prejudice arises, because in failing to give him a statement of the case, they gave him the right under Myers to have his claim stream be considered to have been interrupted and for the effective date to be considered back to 1973.
But couldn't he have raised that with the 86 board?
Yes, he could have.
He could have said, hey, wait a minute, my claim was, of course, the 86 board denied his claim.
That's right. And the problem here, Your Honor, is that what we're dealing with is trying to look in retrospect with what should have happened. Now, to me, it's not appropriate to be second-guessing what the veteran might have done when the error here, the failure to comply with their statutory obligation, is upon the VA. And I think it's important in this record to look at the fact that after the VA acknowledged receipt in April of 1974 at R39, of Mr. Jones's March 1974 notice of disagreement. They made a rating decision in 1974, in July of 1974, at record 52-51, another rating decision in July 1975 at record 57, another one in April of 76 at the record at 96, another one in January of 1977 in the record at 118. So we have a repeated failure of the VA to acknowledge their statutory obligation and treated this as though it were continuing and confirming a decision which had become final. That decision never became final. And it's the failure of the finality of that decision that gives rise to the derivative benefit that a claimant gets under Myers, because his appeal was pending. Not because his claim was pending, but because his appeal was pending. And as a consequence, that's where the prejudice arises to Mr. Jones and to any other veteran who is similarly situated.
Well, why doesn't the analysis in Williams, which applies to a claim, accepting the difference between a claim and an appeal, subsequent final adjudication of a claim, which is identical to a pending claim that had not been finally adjudicated, terminates the pending status of the earlier claim? Why wouldn't you say subsequent final adjudication of an appeal, which is identical to a pending appeal that had not been finally adjudicated, terminates the pending status of the earlier appeal? I'm still having trouble with the 86 not closing out this appeal. You subsume, I understand your position on that.
I think the answer is, Your Honor, is that you cannot finally adjudicate something unfavorably to the veteran when he has a pending appeal. You simply cannot
Why?
Do that as a matter of law, because his original claim and the original decision from 1974 are on appeal.
Correct.
And when they're on appeal, they stay on appeal until they are favorably resolved.
Okay, I see your position.
Right? And that is the difference. It's the favorable resolution, because that's what triggered this court's analysis of an interrupted claim stream under Myers.
I'll just tell you, I'm not following why a favorable one works, but not a non-favorable one. It doesn't make sense to me.
Because, Your Honor, the benefit of the statutory obligation...
Let me lay it straight. You want benefits for a nervous condition. You got denied. You appealed. It stays in appellate status. Through whatever process, you ultimately go to the board for benefits for a nervous condition. You get denied. why doesn't that close the appeal that had been outstanding? You got denied by an appellate board. You could have brought all the issues before that appellate board.
Well, number one, because of this court's decision in Myers. The only way you get around Myers is to say, as Judge Hagel suggested, because of the intervening cases in Juarez, Ingram, and Williams, we will apply the same curative effect to the subsequent adjudication. And that subsequent adjudication, which was negative...
Well, Myers, just to be clear, sure. Myers didn't involve an intervening board decision. What Myers said was the subsequent RO decisions couldn't affect the appellate status of an RO decision that was in appeal.
Right, but what they did...
Okay, so Myers never answered the question of an intervening... what we're now calling an intervening, I would call it the first board decision.
And I'm suggesting that the difference between an intervening rating decision that happened after the fact is no different than an intervening decision by the board.
Why is it
there
intervening?
Why isn't it
the first board decision? In other words, one RO decision left open because you didn't get the decision, they gave it but never mailed it to you, is closed by a subsequent RO decision even when it's a new and material. That's what we held in Juarez. Why isn't it the same with an appellate issue waiting out there for the first board decision on it? That's what I'm not following.
Because the opportunity to receive the benefit isn't in play. It's a legal nullity what the VA did in all of these subsequent decisions because Mr. Jones's original claim was on appeal. And it remained on appeal until his claim was favorably decided. And everything that happened in between is simply
so the Secretary could never do anything until it was favorably decided.
Sure, the Secretary could. The Secretary could recognize his error and issue a statement of the case. Had the Secretary issued his statement of the case before the rating decision in 1986 and acknowledged, in the file is your 1974 notice of disagreement.
So if you got an RO decision, filed an NOD, and they forwarded it to the board without ever giving you a statement of the case, and the board rendered a final decision on that, you would say that board decision just remained open ad infinitum?
Yes, Your Honor. It is not final. It cannot be final as a matter of law, or it undermines the whole notion of 7105. You either have the right to appeal, and initiating appeal tolls, if you will, the finality of that original decision, or it doesn't. And the fact that the VA has done unlawful acts should not be put in their credit.
But if they didn't fulfill the duty to assist, if they didn't get records, if they didn't give you an exam you were required to have, and all these other procedural issues that are not provided to you, they nevertheless don't obviate or take away the finality of a board decision. It's still final. I mean, procedural errors don't keep the board decision itself from being final. Procedural errors before the board decision's decision.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I don't know how you can have due process of law.
I thought that was the Hare case that got overturned by the Federal Circuit, that the procedural due process errors are no longer a basis for Q, for example.
Well, to undo the finality. But the finality of that original decision is not undone by... some alleged procedural error, it's by the fact of there was a statutory obligation, and there's this court's case law beginning in Tablazon and Cow that says you cannot do that.
And if you didn't have a board decision, we'd be agreeing with you, I imagine. In other words, if no board decision had issued, and all we had were subsequent RO decisions, the first one would have remained open in appellate status.
And what the Federal Circuit said in Jackson is that under 5108, that even if the VA decides wrongly that they have jurisdiction, the board must satisfy itself of its jurisdiction. The board had no jurisdiction in 1986. The board cannot create its own jurisdiction. It would only get jurisdiction from the appeal that was not yet completed from the notice of disagreement in March 1974.
Right. I see your time is done. Do you have
I have one question.
Yes.
The 1973 reference to nervous condition, is there any difference between that reference and the nervous condition indicated in the 1986 board decision?
I'm not quite sure I know what you mean. Is there any difference? I think under this court's recent decision in Clemens, the fact, again, that this is a pending appeal requires this matter to go back for consideration of the evidence that has been submitted in the record since that notice of disagreement.
All I want to know is that in your mind, is the nervous condition that's referenced in 86 the same nervous condition that's referenced in 73?
I do not believe that my client had any training or competence to determine what it was that was his disability. And I don't know, and I do not believe he was competent to put a label on what he had. He was seeking disability for a psychiatric condition. Problem that he had.
That he labeled as a nervous condition.
Well, that someone labeled
that someone as labeled. Nervous. And that another someone labeled it in 86 as a nervous condition.
That's correct, and to include post-traumatic stress disorder.
So all I'm asking is if the use of the terms nervous condition in 73 and 86 were synonymous. Are we talking about different nervous conditions?
According to the medical evidence in this record, my client had what I believe was described in the medical record as an anxiety neurosis based upon the VA's examination in 1974 or 5, right around the time that the first decision was made. And he carried that diagnosis until such time as that diagnosis was modified to post-traumatic stress disorder. I do not believe that there are any other psychiatric conditions in the record other than the anxiety neurosis and the post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay.
And I believe the post-traumatic stress disorder appears in the record early in the 1980s.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Lavinia Durr, and with me as co-counsel is David Quinn, representing the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. The 1970 claim is not pending in this case. In 1986 and in 1988, the board issued decisions denying entitlement to a nervous condition to include PTSD and extinguished the 1973 claim.
Could you answer the same question I just asked appellant's counsel?
Your Honor, at this point, we feel it's the same claim. Our position is that it's an identical claim to the one he had filed in 1974, thereby the 1986 claim extinguishes the 1986 board decision extinguishes the 1973 claim.
So the nervous condition claim filed in 74 is the same nervous condition that's referenced in the 86 board decision?
Yes, Your Honor. Under Williams, the court had found that a subsequent final adjudication of a claim, in this case the 1986 board decision, which is identical to a pending claim, in this case the 1973 claim, that had not been finally adjudicated, terminates the pending status of the earlier claim. Contrary to appellant's argument, there is no difference between a pending claim and a pending appeal. There's only two types of status that your claim can be. Under 38 CFR 3.160, your claim can either be a pending claim or a finally adjudicated claim under C and D. A pending claim is a claim which has not been finally adjudicated. And under 38 CFR 3.160D, a finally adjudicated claim is a claim that has been disallowed by the agency of original jurisdiction or by denial on appellate review. In this case, the appellate review of the 1973 claim was during the 1986 board decision and subsequently 1988.
So, counsel, the Secretary's position is that the nervous condition claim filed in 73 was in fact pending because of the lack of an issuance of an SLC up until 1986.
Yes, Your Honor. The reason why, from the record, why an SSC wasn't filed, there appears to be some kind of confusion whether or not it was withdrawn.
but the secretary concedes that basically it was pending that entire time. And during that entire time, between the 1973 claim and the 1986 board decision, he was given, I think, at least six different rating decisions. And then subsequently, when he did file the litigation through the 86 board decision, an SOC was issued. He filed a Form 9, and it was finally denied in 86. And throughout those 13 years, he could have said, he had the opportunity during that time to say that this has been pending. It's a service, it's a claim for service connection for a nervous condition.
Accepting your explanation of the definition of a pending claim and an adjudicated claim, Mr. Carpenter is making the point that when a claim is put into appellate status, there's a different effect upon that claim when a subsequent regional office, agency of original jurisdiction, renders a decision on the claim. It has no effect or impact on the original claim that had been placed in original status, according to Myers. You do agree with that?
I agree that subsequent rating decisions, but in this case, as you pointed out, there's a subsequent board decision, which is the higher tribunal, which adjudicated the identical claim
right.
That was pending.
Well, I guess that, I think I understood Mr. Carpenter's point with regard to a claim in appellate status, whether or not the VA
yes.
regulations.
Yes, okay. There is a difference in this case, Your Honor, that an NOD was filed in this case. But as I said earlier, your claim is either not, putting it in appellate status still makes the claim not finally adjudicated.
Now, if I can restate what I think Mr. Carpenter was saying, is that if the original claim to which an NOD had been filed was standing in appellate status, the appellant was statutorily entitled to a statement of the case, which would explain the issues on appeal, why it was denied. He never got that. And let's just assume for a second that they were issues 1, 2, and 3. The subsequent RO decisions that denied him may have been for issues 5, 6, and 7. And those go up to the board and they get denied and denied. Issues 1, 2, and 3, which were the original basis for the denial, were never provided to the appellant in a statement of the case and never specifically looked at in the 1986 board decision or the 1988 board decision, if I have those dates right, because at that time nobody realized that this other claim was sitting out there. What is the effect if, in fact, that situation occurred? If, in fact, the original one was denied for reasons which, frankly, I don't know that we know here now, but 1, 2, and 3, whereas the others were denied for 4, 5, and 6, and that's what actually got processed.
Okay, Your Honor. In this case, we believe it's the same. It was 1, 2, and 3 that was adjudicated in 1986. It was a nervous condition claim. He kept filing a nervous condition. He participated in the denial of his claims and the litigation of his claims, the adjudication of his claims. It was a nervous condition all throughout. I believe in that scenario, under Williams, it has to be a claim that is identical to the earlier claim. And in this case, the nervous condition is identical.
Well, the claim is identical, but the issues for which it was denied in 1974, again, let's assume the issues are 1, 2, and 3. And the issues for which it was denied subsequently by the RO were 4, 5, and 6. Different issues, different reasons. So the appellant goes up there and argues in 86, reasons 4, 5, and 6, and loses. Argues in 88, 4, 5, and 6, and loses. And ultimately in 95, gets an award. Maybe the award's on 1, 2, and 3. Why is it that back in 1986 and 8, when there's no appeal,
yes, sir.
There's no appeal to the court at the time, why is it that those decisions can close out this otherwise appeal that is outstanding when the appeal never got addressed? And now let me just restate that too. When you have an RO decision during the time that this court has adjudicated these cases, there's always been an appeal to the board.
Yes, sir.
So an RO decision might close out an earlier RO decision because you could have appealed it. But in this case, what would be the claimant's remedy to an 85 board decision denying his claim, or an 86 and 88 board decision denying his claim on 4, 5, and 6 when, hey, I never even knew 1, 2, and 3 were the reason the first one was denied?
that's the, you're saying it's not issues 1, 2, and 3, it's the basis for the denial?
Yeah, that's what I mean by issues, yeah. Same claim. It's the same claim, no question.
Okay.
I think the appellant's argument is focused more on the fact that he didn't get the statutory benefit of being told what these issues were. And therefore, put it in the context of no appeal from the board. Hey, I mean, where am I supposed to take these issues if you didn't address them?
Well, it goes back, I think, Your Honor, to my earlier answer in terms of that he had an opportunity throughout the litigation between from his filing of the 83 rating decision, his 3 or 4 rating decisions prior to that. He had an opportunity during the litigation of his claims to indicate that this is not a reopening. This is a service connection claim. This is, you know, during that time, unfortunately, it was, this court was, you know, the court didn't exist, so therefore he can't have it. The only way he can, since the 86 board decision is still a final decision, whether or not the correctness of it is can only be, the finality of that particular decision can only be pierced through a Q claim or a motion for reconsideration before the board.
If the 86 decision, if the statement of the case that was provided on the way to the 86 decision informed Mr. Jones that that his claim for nervous condition had been denied previously, and didn't provide any reasons for the denial in 74, what would the Secretary say about that situation with regard to whether or not the 74 claim would remain open? I'm not sure I made myself clear when I asked that question. Did you understand the question?
No, Your Honor. In terms of that, there was no...
Well, could I try again?
Okay.
In 1974, we all agree that no SOC was issued.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what this is, I understand the Secretary's position. The Secretary is saying, look, Mr. Jones had a chance to raise this in the 86 board decision.
Yes, Your Honor.
And because he didn't raise it, or when the 86 board decision decided that it denied his claim for a nervous condition, then that, because he had been issued an SOC, that, and he appealed it, and they decided that issue, then that's it, and because there's, of course, no court. Now, what if in the SOC he received, all that was there was denied that your claim has been previously denied, that your claim for nervous condition has been previously denied, and nothing else? Do you think that makes a difference?
Your Honor, I would still argue that that would make an adequate SOC.
Well, that's really like a notice, isn't it? Not an SOC. Isn't an SOC supposed to give all the reasons and statutes and all that kind of stuff?
Yes, Your Honor, but at this point, the finality of the 1986 board decision, it's final, so it can't...
We're back with the SOC leading up to the 86 decision,
yes.
Right? So how does the 86... My question is if an SOC, let me try to be more direct. If an SOC, if the purpose of an SOC is to advise an individual of the reasons why his claim was denied, and in the SOC, a subsequent SOC, which you think will satisfy
the
failure to provide the initial ones, those reasons are not provided, then... How can an individual frame their issues to present to the board so that they have a fair appeal?
Well, Your Honor, I think in this case it didn't. The SOC basically went through the elements of service connection for the nervous condition. I think that January 86 SOC can be found in 218.
I'm sorry.
The SOC for prior to the 86 board decision can be found in 218 and...
Okay, I'm looking at it.
the things that followed.
And now looking at the interest, the entry at, on page 220 at 4676. What does that say?
At 4676.
The entry there. This is the listing of the evidence, right, or the procedural history.
Yes.
Okay. And the entry at 4676 on page 220.
Okay.
If you look at page, you got page 220?
Yes, sir.
You know it says 4676, which is the date.
Yes.
Right? It says claimant notified by letter of denial of service connection for a nervous condition.
Yes, Your Honor. And this was for a rating decision that was after the 74 rating decision.
Right. So let's show me where this, I mean, your assertion is that this SOC is satisfactory.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, show me where it meets the requirements. That's my question. We're talking about to extinguish the 74, right? To give him adequate notice of why the RO denied his 74 claim.
Well, our position is not necessarily that an SOC extinguishes the
74. I didn't mean that. I'm sorry if I misspoke. How does this SOC in 76 give Mr. Jones notice of the reasons and statutes and regulations that upon which the RO in 74 denied the claim for nervous condition? See, the Secretary is jumping and saying, hey, the 86 decision talks all about the fact that we're considering the evidence and your nervous condition is, we consider it and we're denying it. And you're saying that extinguishes it. And as I understand Mr. Jones' position, he's saying, look, it doesn't extinguish anything because that was the 74 claim was still open. And the only way you can close that, in his view, is by issuing an appropriate SOC because this is something he didn't say, but that and the purpose of the SOC is to assist the appellant in framing the issues and arguing why the RO was wrong to the board. So if he doesn't have an adequate SOC, he couldn't have framed his issue to the board, and therefore the board decision could not extinguish the appeal, even though it wouldn't be a final decision because it really didn't encompass everything it was supposed to encompass.
I think it is our position, Your Honor, that in this case, the SOC told him of the denial.
Can you show me where it did?
It talked about the service connection rules in 422.
I'm sorry?
Excuse me, in 222 and talked about the new and material evidence rules, which in this case, of course, is a different claim.
Right.
But I think... more to our point is that even if this is not adequate, it still does not pierce the finality of the 1986 board decision.
No, I'm not saying it cures it.
Okay.
I mean, the 86 board decision is final.
Yes, Your Honor.
The question I think that we're asking is, what preclusive effect does it have on the 74 RO decision?
I think our position is with the Williams case, that it was subsequently adjudicated in a board decision. The same compensation claim.
But
nervous.
As Judge Castle appropriately pointed out, I think that the Williams decision talks about a subsequent RO decision, not a subsequent board decision.
In this case, though, a subsequent board decision, which is even a higher tribunal than the RO decision, extinguishes that particular claim. In Juarez, they had found that an appellant's original claim for service-connected compensation benefits, even if it's still pending at the time, is denied when the RO explicitly determines that new and material evidence had not been submitted to reopen the claim. It even goes on further. It wasn't the case in Juarez, but this case, I think, goes even further, that in this case, not only was there subsequent rating decisions, but there's a subsequent board decision. And in Juarez, they found that the filing of an NOD in Myers distinguishes it because, the proposition that once an NOD has been filed, further RO decisions, which do not grant the benefit, can't resolve the appeal. However, only a subsequent board decision can resolve an appeal that was initiated but not completed. So he did initiate the appeal. Our position isn't that the 1977, the rating decisions in between made that final, saying that basically the board decision being the higher tribunal and that it was an identical claim to the one that was denied in 1974 precludes him from that his claim was final at that point.
But let me approach this from a little different angle. One of the Mr. Jones's arguments is that there's a difference between a board decision that grants a claim and one that denies a claim. And we, Judge Castle, I think, particularly pressed him on, you know, what's the difference? I don't see the difference. Well, let me ask you this. It seems to me that the issue in this case, from the standpoint of the veteran, is what is the effective date of his award? Because he was eventually awarded service connection for PTSD,
yes, sir.
Right? So he's saying, okay, I had this condition all the way back in 73 when I filed my initial claim. Now, so what he's really concerned about is the effective date of his claim. If the VA denies his claim, effective date is never an issue.
Yes, Ron. So it was final.
So it only becomes an issue when his claim is granted. So it seems to me if the board decision is not on all fours, and they deny, or the notice is not on all fours, and they deny his claim, he never has the opportunity to argue effective date because he's arguing service connection.
Yes,
and he has to wait until the agency decides what the effective date is before this issue of the 74 decision and the subsequent decisions, the 86 board and all that would ever arise, right?
Yes, but Your Honor, in this case, he filed his claim in May 19. There's a final decision in 86. There's a final decision in 88. He files his claim in 1989. Thereafter, then he can get the effective date. But if there were no final decision prior to that, he can still attempt to get an effective date, but the effective date rules under, I believe, 5110 is your date of your application to reopen, or the date entitlement arose, whichever is later. In this case, he filed his application May 19, 1989, and although there's no confirmed diagnosis of PTSD until 1991, the board didn't disturb the finding that the effective date was the date of when he reopened his claim in May 1989.
Well, I understand it's the Secretary's position, but that all hinges on the fact that the 86 decision was final.
Yes, Your Honor. It's
a final adjudication of his 74 claim. It all hinges on that, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
You're not asserting that the 88 decision was a final adjudication, are you?
No, Your Honor. Well, it is a final adjudication.
A final adjudication of the 74 claim.
No, Your Honor. The 74 claim, if it remained pending, it remained pending until 1986. Again, under Williams, it was under, because it was an identical claim that was denied by the higher tribunal, the board, at that time. The claim stopped. Attempts to reopen, board issues a decision in 88. Thereafter, that becomes a final decision. In 1989, he files to reopen, and that's where his effects. That's the only date that his effective date. That's the earliest date his effective date should be.
Is there any merit to the argument that, in fact, Mr. Jones was prejudiced by the VA not sending the SOC such that he could have appealed to the board at that point and may have gotten an earlier effective date to the date of his original claim of 73?
No, Your Honor. He could have, if he had argued that this claim had been pending, in the SOC it was said that it was a new and material claim that was denied. He could have made additional arguments in his Form 9, and the board could have addressed that also during the 1986 board decision.
So your position is that the appellant was not prejudiced by the VA's failure to send a statement of the case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because
he was subsequently issued during the January 87 statement of the case that then
January when?
January
10 years later or 13 years later?
January 86 nervous condition, the SOC, the January 86 SOC.
But that's 13 years later.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, there was a procedural, you know, defect in the that the SOC wasn't issued after this, and that later on he was with the rating decisions. But in the end, once that board decision basically adjudicated an issue that was identical to the one that was on, in appellate status, the one that had was a pending claim and that had not been finally adjudicated, once that 1986 board decision was issued, the only way he can pierce the finality of that particular decision is, like I said, with a Q motion or a recon motion.
But procedurally, could he not have appealed a decision earlier than 86 and thereby gotten the earlier final decision?
In the subsequent rating decisions, Your Honor?
Yes.
Yes, he could have appealed those decisions and gotten an SOC and, you know, then received an effective date at that point, an earlier effective date at that point.
And your position is he did not do so?
He did not do so throughout the litigation of the claim.
Okay.
Let me take you to a claim filed in 1980, denied in 1981, NOD filed, statement of the case says simply your claim has been denied. Doesn't really provide much information. Very similar to what I believe Judge Hagel was reading. A board decision is rendered in 1984. Is that okay, you have 4 minutes and 40 seconds to which we'll add a little time. Don't worry.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I was confused.
Our clock is not exactly working right, I guess.
Just to proceed chronologically, because I'd like to go or start with the statement of the case, but just to proceed chronologically, if the court would direct its attention to page 33 of the record. This is the VA's notice to Mr. Jones of what they did in the February 5th, 1974 rating decision. At the bottom of the page, it says, nervous condition was not shown by evidence of record, and then hyphen it says St. Paul. I have no idea what the reference is to St. Paul, the saint, or the city. But that's the only notice he got. And based upon that notice, he filed a disagreement, and the VA has conceded that he filed a notice of disagreement. On the very next page, at page 34 of the record, it describes the fact that this is somehow a reopened claim received September 17, 1973. In the findings, there is a single sentence that says, there is no evidence of treatment during service for a nervous condition. There is no other reference in the findings. And under the rating, which is amended as follows from 1971, it says nervous condition claimed by veteran not shown by the evidence of record. So even if you infer that the veteran was able or capable of understanding what the VA did, the VA didn't explain to him other than the fact that he didn't have evidence of record at the time.
Because I don't think they were required to then, were they?
No, but we're talking about what the prejudice is to the veteran. And the prejudice is predicated upon what actual knowledge he could have had from the record. Then going to page 39 of the record, when the VA responds to his notice of disagreement, the VA says, pending receipt of these reports, referring to some reports about treatment, we will not consider your recent letter a notice of disagreement for the purposes of initiating an appeal. Clearly, in my view, that is a misstatement of the law. They do not have the right to decide whether to accept or not to accept a statement of the case. And then they go on to say, when we receive the evidence, we will again review your claim, and if your decision remains unfavorable, you will again have the opportunity to express disagreement and request appellate review. So they have now misled him not once, but twice, about his ability to proceed with his appeal, suggesting that they can arbitrarily decide whether to accept the appeal or not to accept the appeal, and that he will have to file a second notice of disagreement, neither of which are a correct statement.
Yeah, we all agree with that. We want to know why. We want to know the effect of the events leading up to the 86
and
decision.
I'm just about to change gears. If you'll move then to page 218 of the record, where we find the January 1986 statement of the case. As was discussed in this court's discussion with the VA, this statement of case is not based upon a reopening of the 1974 decision. It is based upon a reopening of an April 1976 decision. And it quite clearly states that this is a reopened claim received in 1984, based upon, apparently, according to this statement of case, an attempt to reopen the 1976 decision. Therefore, this statement of case could not possibly have placed Mr. Jones on notice that in 1986 they were going to make a decision on his pending appeal from 1974. And in point of fact, and this is where the confusion comes in with the text of the board's decision, in explaining to Mr. Jones what it was that was deficient or the reasons for their decision, it was all about the fact that he did not have new and material evidence to reopen his 1976 claim. Or, excuse me, the 1976 decision that was previously denied by the VA. At page 223... of the record, it says, no new and material evidence has been presented to establish service connection for a nervous condition previously denied. And that previous denial was a 1976 denial. It is simply unreasonable to suggest that the statement of the case that was received as part of the 1986 appellate process could in any way have put Mr. Jones on notice of the evidence required to prevail. And in fact, this statement of the case suggests that all that was at issue in the board's decision in 1986 was the question of new and material evidence. As this court has correctly pointed out, they, in fact, treated it both ways, both as a new claim and as entitlement in the first instance. And that is different from what was placed at before the veteran in the 1986 statement of the case. I respectfully disagree with the court's with Judge Hagel's assertion that the 1986 decision is final. I do not believe that the 1986 decision can be final because it is not predicated on valid jurisdictional grounds. Under this court's decision in Tablazon, you cannot have a claim to reopen if there is a pending appeal. What this court did in Tablazon was to dismiss an appeal that was taken to this court from a board decision because they found that the board had no jurisdiction to consider the new and material evidence question. That's precisely what was decided in 1986 based upon the statement of case and based upon the text of the decision in 1986, and in my view, that's all they would have had the potential authority to have done had there not been a pending appeal, had there in fact been a final decision in 1976. But Myers teaches us that we can't have a final decision in 1976 because there was a pending notice of disagreement that was filed in 1974. Ultimately, Mr. Jones is in the position, as I believe Judge Hagel correctly suggested in his questioning, to challenge effective date for the first time. Until the 1998 decision that ultimately granted the benefit in this case, there was not an opportunity for Mr. Jones to have challenged effective date. There had never been a prior effective date determination made, and that effective date determination was directly appealed by Mr. Jones and is before this court now. And it is in that context that we have to examine whether or not a pending appeal is different, and contrary to what the government has suggested, a pending appeal is different from a pending claim. And as a consequence, the only way that that pending appeal can be resolved is by the issuance of a statement of the case or, under Myers, by the issuance of a favorable decision, which then identifies the interrupted claim stream because the claim has now been fully adjudicated. And that's the first time that Mr. Jones's claim was fully adjudicated. These interim adjudications, whether the half dozen at the RO level before the 86 and 88 decisions or the two board decisions, none of those are final and can be considered final until the matter was finally favorably decided. And then at issue for the first time is the question of effective date. Don't believe I have anything further to add unless there's any further questions. I will relinquish my remaining time now that it's
thank
been
you very much. Thank you. The case will be submitted, and we will come greet counsel.
All rise. This honorable court is adjourned until further notice.